that's been around for centuries.
Let's see here. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody. God, this is awful. Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or f*** with Discorder online at discorder.ca.
Just to begin, if you could introduce yourself, that would be wonderful.
Okay, yes, I'm Neil.
We are broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. This is UBC Happy Hour, a show that is all about what's happening on UBC campus. This show is produced by the UBC Affairs Collective. If you like what you hear and you'd like to help make this show, or if there's something that you'd like to see covered on the show, send us an email at ubcaffairs@citr.ca. I'm Julia Ferry.
I'm Sadie Lai.
I'm Lillane.
And I'm Alex Lenz. I'm the kind of coordinator of the show, and Julia, Sadie, and Lillane are all awesome contributors on the show, so really excited to have everyone here today. So to start us off, Julia, you did an interview with a prof, and we're going to air the interview, so do you want to just kind of tell us quickly about it?
Yeah, of course. So this wonderful professor from the Department of Sociology took a couple of, a good solid chunk of his time out of his day and decided to give us an interview. So we're just going to jump right into it.
Just to begin, if you could introduce yourself, that would be wonderful.
Okay, yes, I'm Neil Guppy, professor here at the University of British Columbia. I've been here since 1979 in the Department of Sociology. Teach introductory sociology, most recently interests in inequality education.
Wonderful. And so we have Professor Guppy here today because recently there was a UBC broadcast email that was sent out about the freedom of expression, and you are the head of the discussion board, is that correct?
Yes, we've got a working group, 10 of us all together, and people from across campus asked by the president to draft up some notes on freedom of expression and to create a conversation on campus around the importance of freedom of expression, what kinds of limits, if any, there should be on freedom of expression, and how in a modern academy we should address this issue.
Mm-hmm. So what was the motivation of bringing this group together? Was there some kind of event that happened, or was it just something that you felt was about time that happened?
Yeah, UBC has a whole variety of policies, statements, etc., on aspects of freedom of expression. So we have a 1976 statement on academic freedom that's been in the calendar. We have a respectful environment policy. We have a statement that President Toop issued when he was here. I think that was 2009. And so this largely was how do all of our policies commingle? How do they all exist in some kind of message, not necessarily of consensus, but coherence? Many other institutions are feeling that the issues of freedom of speech and especially in the United States, have been under attack, and we've had speakers from the alt-right that have caused serious disturbances at some universities. So where are we at UBC with respect to the kinds of statements and procedures that that exist?
So then I guess that leads me to ponder, what kind of mission would this discussion board have? Would it include having kind of outreach groups or support groups, or just a policy to create regulations of how things are expressed academically?
Yeah, I don't think there's any sense of regulation in this at this stage. It's a conversation to try to think through, well, what exactly, how, first of all, how does freedom of expression in Canada differ from free speech in the United States? So these are very different concepts. The United States has free speech built right into the Constitution. In Canada, freedom of expression is one of a variety of different rights. Some people will say, especially in the university context, that it is the right and nothing else should trample it or extinguish it. Other people will say, well, wait a second, the Canadian Constitution, for example, we talk about freedom of expression, but we also talk about equality, we talk about multiculturalism. So if you read the Constitution in a kind of holistic way, all of these rights or values, etc., are considered together. In a university context, the idea of being able to speak your mind, to be able to pursue whatever research questions you want to pursue, to be able to go down whatever rabbit holes you might choose to focus upon, that's clearly up to you, and there should be nothing, this is more academic freedom, there should be nothing that restricts that. When it comes to freedom of expression, the idea of an artistic display on campus or the idea of people speaking their mind on a variety of issues, I don't think we should put in place barriers to prohibit that. On the other hand, one of the things that's changed in universities is we've become much more cosmopolitan, much more diverse. We've got a whole array of groups that one sense were never at universities. Women, for example, were never in universities in the earliest times. We've become much more diverse along racial, ethnic, and ancestral grounds. And as we've brought more and more people into the university, there is increasing conflict between the different religious views, language views, just kind of cultural sense that people bring, and sometimes some of the things that we say cause offense and cause a feeling that, you know, this isn't the dignified civil discourse that we ought to have here. People need to be more respectful of one another. So there's a discussion about, should freedom of expression in some way be curtailed to take account of the community in which you're in?
Thinking about the expression of art that you've just been talking about and how it would be important to help, I guess, bring ideas to the forefront. Recently on UBC campus, there was an incident where there was vandalism that was happening. One was a huge pink dollar sign that was written on the plaza, and then another one was on a blackboard at the Forestry Building that said some Heil Hitler, which was very offensive to some people. So in that sense, my question would be, there's a lot of art forms where people really just are bold in their statements. Do you think that that would be something that needs to be considered in this policy? Because vandalism, for example, is frowned upon, it seems like.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of vandalism at all. I don't think we should go around vandalizing things. Certainly the notion of bold and creative art, I'm all in favor of. There are, quite rightly, barriers or boundaries that we don't want to cross, but those are well-defined. Well, I mean, I don't say well-defined. Those are defined in Canadian law, and if there is something on campus that one would see as art that was promoting hatred towards identifiable groups, then it would be the RCMP who would come and would look at that, would make decisions through the criminal justice system as to whether or not charges should be laid. So I think we already have in place hate speech and hate laws and laws about derogating other people that are a fairly high bar. But they do exist, and the idea that we would try to trample on other people's rights and values over the top of that bar, I think is wrong and is in the criminal code.
Fair enough, yeah. And then I guess on the other spectrum of being able to freely express, there's also the other side of safe spaces and community building. On UBC campus, I feel that there are events that really highlight that issue of making sure that there's a lot of spaces that people can come to and comfortably speak out, especially minority groups, especially in the light of Truth and Reconciliation. How do you imagine these safe spaces to be and how they would be interpreted?
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea that people feel comfortable to work and learn on a university environment in ways that they are free to voice their key ideas, the things that they're passionate about and that they care about. I think I look at this, and this goes to the balance, right? There is on the one hand, everybody should have the freedom to be able to say whatever they want, wherever they want, whenever they want. And I respect that and think, yeah, absolutely. But is that a fundamental right that has no limits whatsoever on it? And increasingly, I'm starting to think, no, I want to work in a civil, dignified community where you and I and our co-inhabitants in this space respect one another and can talk and debate vigorously. We can hear abhorrent views that other people may have, but they're not going to be views that are going to undermine our identity, our confidence, make us feel unsafe. So those views ought not be inciting violence. They ought not be targeting particular groups. They ought not be ad hominem attacks on individual people. So I think there's a sense of respect and dignity that I believe that has to go with the notion of freedom of expression. So I want us to be able to pursue vigorously the most complex, the most difficult conversations that we can imagine. We've got to have space to be able to do that. On the other hand, we also have to recognize that we're a community, and we're a community of people trying to work and learn and pursue the truth together.
Okay.
Or pursue truth together.
Yeah, that's interesting. There's this one academic named Jordan Peterson. I don't know if you've heard of him. He recently visited UBC, but he says something about being able to speak out your ideas so that you're able to make mistakes and be open to correction. Do you think that there are some things that could be said that couldn't be taken back or corrected because it's just too abhorrent or too offensive?
I'm not quite sure that I know how to answer that question. Certainly the idea of hate speech or things that are done carelessly, that to me is not hate speech. Now, and what I mean by that are kind of remarks that someone might make, that I might make about someone who is older, for example. And I don't quite recognize that in what I'm saying and how I'm contextualizing that, I'm actually insulting somebody who is who's elderly. It's wrong for me to have done that, but if I do that in a careless manner, it's irresponsible, but I don't think it's what I'm going to call reprehensible. So I think there's a kind of line there. It's when people are deliberately trying to undermine someone because of their religion, because of their language, because of their age. That, I think, is where this notion of hate speech comes in. So the idea that people may say things and be wrong about them, well, we're an institution where we're all in the game of making mistakes and correcting one another and having conversations that are difficult and challenging and often very highly charged. And yes, sometimes I'm sure I will say things that I later look at and think, ooh, wait a sec, I didn't quite mean it that way. I'm sure in this interview I probably already said a couple of things that I'll listen to afterwards and think, oh, I wish I had sort of said it this way instead of the way that I actually said it. So, yeah, I think the idea that we make mistakes and we ought to be allowed to make those mistakes, absolutely. But I don't think we can hide behind the notion, oh, I deliberately insulted somebody through hate speech, and oh, that was just a careless little mistake I made. That doesn't wash for me.
Doing these mistakes and having these, kind of realizing that something might have gone wrong, I feel like will require a lot of dialogue and always making that effort to go back to that dialogue and not being afraid to do so. I guess this is a little bit related to our day and age where we're using the internet, personally I feel that there's a lot of sentiment that we're always busy, like we were talking about before. We're always on our own track trying to get through everything. So in that time, how do you think we could encourage students to be more involved in taking that time? Because I perceive that there is no time sometimes.
Yeah, I guess maybe the way that I'd approach that is we all need to pause a little bit before we hit the send button, whether it's the send button in our vocal cords or the send button on our social media. Sometimes it's worth reflecting and just thinking about what it is that we're saying. So as a sociologist, one of the concepts that sociologists use a lot is taking the role of the other. So as I'm doing this, one of the things I ought to be thinking a little bit about is who might be listening to this, and as they're listening, what are they going to be thinking about kind of what I'm saying? So I put myself in the role of the listener. Well, if you think about this around this idea of hate speech, that we're not individuals that can spout out ideas without contemplating the ramifications of those ideas. So I think taking the time to be reflective, taking the time to be a little bit thoughtful, and effectively taking the time to remember that we're social animals, and social animals live in community, and so therefore the things that we say are things that our co-inhabitants are going to hear and interpret. And we want as much as we can to have those people interpreting that in ways that aren't harmful to them or hurtful to them. Especially in a university, we want progressive dialogue that's going to help us in understanding, help us in communication, etc. So it's that notion, I guess, of time and reflection that's important to what we do. And yeah, everybody's life is getting faster. In part it's social media, but in part it's a whole variety of trying on different aspects of our lives. We all now do many different things, right? We're a student, and we're a guitarist, and we're a mountain climber, and we're having a holiday, and we've got a lover, and we're doing on and on and on. So we just are I'm not sure what the multiple of multitasking is, but whatever that is. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
So now that you've referenced the audience that's listening right now, how are they able to join into this conversation of freedom of expression?
Yes. Well, if they go to the UBC website, or if they probably just Google UBC freedom of expression, they'll find a site where we're getting input on the freedom of expression document that we've written. We've probably heard from about 120 people in the past 2 days, 3 days, I guess it is. We're working to, first of all, kind of capture all of those comments. At the moment, it's a bit too much, in my judgment, of a feedback form, so send in your note, but you don't get to see what anybody else has said. We're working to change that, and hopefully next week we'll have that changed up. So there's a freedom of expression site. We're looking for people to read through the document and give us their feedback. What could make this a better statement? What would work for you to make this a statement that you think the university should stand behind? And hopefully, as I say, in the next week or so, we'll have this more of a conversation than a kind of one-way, here comes feedback.
Yes, definitely. And would these submissions be anonymous, or
we're asking people to sign them, to put their names on them, just to be accountable for what it is that's being said. my own thought, I don't know whether this is exactly what will happen, but my own thought is when we put them back up on the web and post them so that other people can comment on them, we'll put them up so that it doesn't say Neil Guppy, it'll say NG. So in that sense, they'll be a little bit anonymous, but we really do want to be able, so I've read all of the ones that have come in so far. There are people that have made some very, very useful, helpful suggestions. I want to be able to write back to those people and say, hey, thanks. We use the word terrorism in the first two lines of this freedom of expression document. Two or three people have said to us, I shouldn't do that. Terrorism, right, focuses on a particular group, and you may not be intending to do that, but that's how I read what's going on here. Why don't you just call it political violence? I kind of hear that and think, yeah. That's, in one sense, a simple thing, but it's a pretty important thing for, obviously, several people that have responded, and therefore probably a lot of other people who haven't responded but have also read it and thought, oh, I don't like that. So we'll get lots of changes of that sort. So that is another reason that it's not anonymous as such. So, and we'll ask some people as well, I think, to expand on their views, right? We get a couple of really good suggestions, and you sort of read it and think, oh, this person maybe is a law prof at UBC. I don't know who exactly this is, but gee, what they're saying about hate speech, it'd be nice to learn a little bit more about how they actually think we might be able to refine what we say in the document about that.
And so that's until the 30th of November that those submissions can be made.
Yeah, submissions can come till the 30th of November. My hope is that we'll continue the conversation on beyond then, that's a kind of deadline to encourage people to respond. What exactly will happen subsequent to that, stay tuned. I don't know, and I don't know that anybody knows. To some extent, it depends on the kind of comments and feedback that we get. Mm-hmm. So if people have suggestions as to what ought to follow, let's hear them. Mm-hmm.
To freedom of expression.
Right, yes, exactly.
All right, well, thank you so much for the interview.
Okay, thank you.
Hey everyone, you're back listening to the UBC Happy Hour. You just heard Julia Ferry, one of our contributors, and she's here with us. She interviewed Neil Guppy. He's a sociology professor here at UBC, and he's also part of a working group that's looking at freedom of speech on campus and how campus should kind of go about implementing freedom of speech. This is a huge topic that's being covered in campuses across the country. And part of that, I would arguably say, has been spurred by the tours and the lectures put on by Jordan Peterson. So Jordan Peterson is, he recently did a speech at UBC that was put on by the UBC Free Speech Club. So he's a University of Toronto professor of psychology, if I believe correctly. And he basically has kind of been in the news a lot because he has some controversial opinions about free speech. So, and the UBC Free Speech Club also has been kind of mired in controversy. So Jack Huan from the UBC went and wrote an article about his talk. And we're also joined right now by a UBC writer. She is the opinions editor, the blog editor, Emma Hicks. She's with us today. Hi. And Emma's going to talk later about a piece that she recently did, but she's also a great source of this discussion because she has been they recently published a editorial piece of a student who disagreed with Jack's article about Jordan Peterson. So I'm just going to quickly read a little bit from the article so that you guys know what we're talking about. So Peterson, the University of Toronto psychology professor who has turned an online lecture series into a gold mine that nets him at least $800,000 a year, came to UBC Friday night to talk about the perils of postmodernism and quote-unquote neo-Marxism, the ideologies that he puts forth have turned our universities into quote-unquote walking corpses and our children into despot-worshipping sociopaths. Now, he says, it's coming for the rest of us. Peterson rose to prominence protesting Bill C-16, which gives gender expression and identity protection under the Canadian Human Rights Act and Criminal Code. More specifically, it's now illegal to deny services, employment, accommodation, etc. to individuals based on their gender identity or to promote genocide against them. Peterson believes that this will result in quote-unquote compelled speech, that if a person refuses to use someone else's preferred gender pronouns, they'll be charged with hate crime. The panic is misplaced, according to the Canadian Bar Association and most other legal experts. But Peterson's refusal to give up the fight has only endeared him further to the right, including UBC's own Free Speech Club, which organized the event. So Jack kind of went on to give a summary of the talk, and he was quite critical of Peterson's standpoint. So a quote from Jack is, "Peterson's easy demonization of the quote-unquote radical left is familiar to anyone who has watched his clips on YouTube. He's really popular on YouTube. He makes a ton of money off of this." I guess one thing that I think about is, like, how what are the regulations around, like, profs being able to earn such a substantial amount of money outside of their university income? Like, that's a little bit disconcerting to me that a professor can make $800,000 in addition to the probably hundreds of thousands they're already making from the university. So Jack got a lot of backlash from this article. There were a lot of, like, negative comments on Facebook. And I think he told me that he also got, like, a pretty mean email from someone kind of challenging his opinions. But I don't know, Jack's a tough guy, maybe not. I think he can take it. But there was definitely a lot of backlash from this. And it wasn't really said in the article, but Jack did say that the kind of majority of the audience was white young men, which doesn't come as much as a surprise to me. But I was a little bit surprised because tickets to the talk were $60. So it wasn't free for students, which is kind of, you know, a little bit disconcerting in my opinion, because it's pretty expensive.
I would think that the price being $60 is quite frightening, because that kind of shows how much demand there is for that type of talk too as well. And something to think about is what Jordan Peterson is saying, right? Because the stance that he takes on Bill C-16 to use gender pronouns and to be really receptive of people's gender identity, I feel like is appalling, how he says, no, I'm not going to use those pronouns. But something to think about what he says is to be able to have discussions, which I feel like that's something that we could all learn from. And maybe that's kind of what people are grabbing at. But at the same time, bringing it back to the concept of being so extreme in his statements, I feel like it's really disconcerting, because it can affect a lot of people, including Mary Bryson, who is a senior associate dean, administration and faculty affairs and innovator, and professor of the language literacy education. She has quite a long, extensive list of qualifications. And she was actually at the discussion in Ottawa, about the bill. And supposedly when they were having a head-on discussion afterwards, she received a lot of mail that was talking about her gender, and really it was really aggressive. And it's just unfortunate that he's saying something valid, but then he's also inviting a culture that could be very violent.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive to the idea of freedom of speech, you know. So if people are allowed to kind of protest what you say about freedom of speech, is that not freedom of speech? Like, it's kind of paradoxical. And I think that the whole concept also of it too, you know, costing so much, like, maybe for people who are not students or who are older, $60 might not be a lot, but especially to, like, a younger audience, and, like, it's being held at UBC, I think that the institution should kind of, like, be aware of that there's someone making a lot of money off of this. And it's like, it definitely makes me think, like, this is not necessarily motivated by morality or values, and it's more financially motivated, is kind of how I've seen it. But Emma, I understand that the UBC just published an editorial piece of a student who disagreed with Jack. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's actually just a letter in response published in our opinion section. So it wasn't actually an editorial, but basically what the article was saying was that he was disagreeing with Jack's definition of race in the original article. So I'll just read the quote from Jack's article. He said, "The definition of racism as a set of systemic and institutional functions which promote the continued dominance of a particular race, that being the one most academics agree on." So the writer of the letter took great issue with that, which is totally justified, and provided his own. And he said, "Prejudice, discrimination, or antagonism directed against someone of a different race based on the belief that one's own race is superior." And yeah, so he was just kind of challenging Jack. He was just challenging him to think like a little bit further and take that extra step in taking privilege out of the conversation. So I think he was just trying to break it down. And I think that's very important. And we are talking about free speech. So definitely a conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've taken numerous sociology courses over my UBC career. And I was taught in my first year sociology class by, I can't remember her last name, but her first name was Sylvia. And she was this awesome.
Gregory, was it?
Maybe, yeah.
I feel like I had her.
She was like a short, fiery woman with like a short, dark hair. I don't know if you remember her. But she was really awesome. But I remember her teaching us like the definition of racism was prejudice plus power. So when people talk about like counter racism, like, oh, like black people are, you know, being racist towards white people, we learned it in the context of like that would be prejudice but not racism, because typically like white people have had power over black people. So that was how I learned it. So when I read Jack's definition of it, I did agree with it, but that was how I was taught. So it's also interesting how like we're taught certain definitions and how there's so much like opinion and variance over definitions that lead to these arguments. But it's like if we had, you know, a clear definition of something, it like maybe we wouldn't be having these arguments, but it's all semantics, but it's really important. So yeah.
But thinking about semantics, I feel like if we have really strict definitions, sometimes that can cage us into a specific way of being, and that turns into something that's static. So I feel like this whole discussion, even that one we're having right now, is allowing us to define something, but also let it live through the discussions that we have. So I could understand the point of saying we need to make a definition, but I feel like it could always be ongoing to be defining something. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, and especially when terms are so like broad and far-reaching, it's not so simple. But yeah, and I think it's even interesting, like I remember thinking when I was in that sociology class that it was that I had never actually thought about what the definition of racism was. You know, I remember being like, oh, I've never even kind of like conceptualized this in my head. And I think that like even learning it in a university class was really interesting, because, you know, it's not really like you're going to get so many different interpretations. But and then it's like, you know, learning it in the class from that interpretation. So, yeah, I think that that's a really interesting piece. And if you want to read the letter that that student wrote, you can check it out on UBC's website.
Oh, I was just going to add, I think it's also really limiting to limit ourselves to one definition, and it should be something that we are always trying to improve our understanding and being flexible. If we stick with such a rigid definition personally, I think that's really limiting for social growth.
Yeah, totally. So moving on to another piece that Emma wrote, so not related to free speech, but related to hazmat suits and confusion on campus, which for some reason I don't think is like out of the ordinary. Like, I'm like, have I heard this story before at UBC? Like, so yeah, there was a lot of commotion on campus on Monday. People were wondering what was happening. So Emma, what happened on Monday?
Yeah, honestly, it was very bizarre. So Mondays at the UBC office are usually very hectic. It's like the day we prepare our print issue. So we were all doing our layout, and all of a sudden our photo editor just like bolts out of the office, and we're like, where is he going? Like, we need him in this moment. And he's like, there's a huge thing of mercury outside the nest. And we're all like, oh my God. So the news editors are like running after him, like trying to get the story. And they come back and we realize the drop was about the size of my fingernail. And we were like, so this was the big mercury spill. And honestly, like, I'm not in sciences. I stopped taking science after grade 10. So I didn't know really, like,
I'm like,
how...
what is mercury?
Okay, no.
So, I do know what mercury is.
I was like, how did that get there? That was honestly my main question. So I was like, mercury is in the thermometer. Okay, I know that. But then, like, who actually has a thermometer, like, at university? Who's that mature? Is anyone? I don't know. Maybe it's just me. But... so, yeah, we were all trying to figure out how this spill happened. And our photo editor said a puppy stepped on it, which is how it was discovered, which is very upsetting. Like, I guess its paw got hurt.
No.
Which, like, our entire office was, like, very distraught about. It hasn't been 100% confirmed that that was actually the case, just to be clear. I don't know why our photo editor would, like, make that up, so I'm going to, like, go with that. But, yeah.
So they think that a puppy stepped on a thermometer?
On the mercury spill. So we don't know how the mercury got there yet, which is still pretty bizarre.
This is like conspiracy.
Right?
Like,
because it's a bunch of people like on Facebook were making jokes like, oh, it was the chemistry students. But it wasn't near the chem building. And I don't know. I guess it could have come from batteries or light bulbs or something. But we don't know how it got there. And... I mean, it's great that UBC has such great response time and, like, multitudes of fire trucks and hazmat trucks and all these people that were very dedicated to cleaning up this spill. But, yeah, it was just hilarious. Like, it's a serious situation, of course. Like, mercury's toxic. But at the end of the day, it's just something you kind of have to laugh about. So
yeah, I'm imagining, like, UBC, like, emergency preparedness being like, we got this. Like, we've been ready for 10 years to deal with a mercury spill. Like, finally. But it's so weird. So it just kind of, like, who identified it or kind of who brought it to the attention of the school? Do we know?
I guess the dog's owner.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I guess...
the dog.
I guess, like, the dog reacted and, like, maybe, I don't know, lifted up their paw. That's kind of what I'm imagining in my, like, sad horror story in my mind of this. But... yeah, and I guess somebody just, there's a photo in the article that actually shows the size of it. I'm not sure if you have all seen it, but I'm not kidding when I say it's the size of my fingernail. So the fact that it even got discovered from that is pretty, it's pretty odd. Like, I'm not, yeah. I'm really not sure how it happened.
How did they know it was mercury in the first place?
I guess they called campus security first and, saw some weird substance. I don't know if they tested it or not. Like, I honestly, this is blog for you. Like, we do not, we get all the reject funny news stories, like the cars on stairs and all that jazz. That's like how the blog got started. But yeah, it's like people love these kinds of stories that are just so ridiculous and just like make no sense.
And like, in all fairness, I mean, everyone like in the nest area was talking about it. Like,
oh, yeah.
People were like, what is going on? You know, and I was like, are they putting up the shadow art installation right now? No, they weren't. It was a mercury spill. But Sadie, you're in science. Like, do you have any word about this?
Honestly, outside of a thermometer, I don't know where you'd get mercury. And more to the point, why was it just spilled? Like, it would be so hard to get it out of any of the chem labs. I also think it's really funny that even though the nest was talking all about it, this is like the first I'm hearing about this.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my God. I feel like it was everywhere on social media, but honestly, I get that from the paper, I think, so that could be something, but yeah.
Speaking of social media, for anyone who doesn't know, UBC and SFU are... at war over memes. So it's a pretty funny story. Basically, so a meme, for anyone who doesn't know, is a humorous image, video, piece of text, etc., that is copied, often with slight variations, and spread rapidly by internet users. That is the definition that I pulled up from Google. So thank you, Google. So basically, I guess this all started when the UBC class of 2021 Facebook page made one meme about SFU. And then I guess there must have been some kind of SFU spy in that group or something. And then SFU on November 3 declared meme war on UBC. So it's been really weird. Lalaine and Sadie, you guys are in the class of 2021. So, like, what's the scoop?
Yeah, I'm a first year, and I'm in the class of 2021 page, and basically what's happening right now is there's just so many posts about memes against SFU, UVic, and yeah, it's getting really repetitive. It's about calling SFU garbage or yeah, that kind of stuff. It's getting a little distasteful now. It's just like rising.
Yeah, so basically like they're kind of like dissing each other through these like internet images. But it kind of got taken to like a whole nother level when SFU made a meme about UBC involving like they brought up kind of rape culture at UBC and like sexual assault cases, which received a lot of negative backlash on social media, understandably so. And so, yeah, it's kind of gotten taken to like a whole other level. But the memes are continuing. Like there've been new ones today. There was like a video of someone like putting something in the trash can and had like
like a GIF.
Yeah, and it had like SFU on it. And so it's been kind of crazy. Yeah. But any signs of it stopping?
No. Even till this day, people are still posting in the page. Like, I don't see any new memes on the UBC Confessions, which is the main page where people post memes. But yeah, on the Class of 2021 page, yeah, memes are still being posted like every day.
And yeah. Emma, there was an article just published in the blog about this.
Yeah. Okay. So again, just kind of like a crazy, weird story where the blog falls. Yeah, so we're seeing a lot of it on Reddit, and people are making their own memes there. I'm not in the Class of 2021 group, so I'm not sure how many are in there as well. But people are getting frustrated. They're saying, am I, like, the only one whose Facebook news feed is all UBC memes? Yeah. Like, we don't care that much. And, like, BCIT, Douglas College, like, they're all coming into it now. And it's getting pretty ridiculous. But what started out as like a light joke did turn into a bit something more. SFU, yeah, really.
Yeah, they kind of took it to a level I don't think it should have been taken to. And it's fine to like joke about us like garbage or like UBC students are like basic because we like love Starbucks and we have frats or like, I don't know, like we can joke about that kind of stuff. But I think there are some topics that aren't really appropriate for memes. And I think that was very evident on Facebook, as far as I could see, like the reactions that and comments that people were making. They were kind of really actually scolding SFU for that. But what was the quote that you guys had from the guy who kind of started this in UBC? Or?
Oh, yeah, sure. So Luke, sorry if I mispronounce this last name, but Breed Cooper, who's an admin of the UBC Class of 2021 Facebook group, just said, I think SFU won the war because UBC's meme quality was low. Most of the memes are reversible and not unique to SFU. That paired with UBC not posting as many memes means they had higher volume and quality. Why? I think they had to dig deeper into things unique to UBC since they don't have as much of a reputation as ours to fall back on. So they were basically attacking like our high tuition fees, endless construction, pretentiousness, and in the case, yeah, sexual assault cases, which they took it a little too far there. But
yeah, I love that this guy Luke has like a really strong criteria for like what makes good memes.
Yeah. He started a chat like for meme warriors, and then people who post memes on the page, but he would invite them into the chat so they have more organized memes. Yeah.
Wow, this guy's organized.
It's getting like, intense.
Yeah, like yeah. this is why it's a war. Like he has like an army of warriors.
He calls them warriors. Yeah.
That is so crazy. Yeah, so if you're curious about these memes, you can check out like UBC Confession Facebook page. It's open for anyone to like, so you can see what's happening. You can like SFU's confession page. I weirdly like a lot of campuses' confession pages. Like, a lot of my friends go to Carleton in Ottawa, and, like, I love their confession page. It's, or, like, no, it's Spotted at Carleton. And I'm like, my friends are like, why are you so obsessed with the Carleton Spotted page? I'm like, it's just so cute. Like, I don't know. People are always like, I saw this person. And I'm like, imagining myself at this campus, like, in another life. But, yeah, I don't know. Confession pages are really funny. So if you want to check them out, that's where they are. Emma, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we're looking forward to more crazy blog posts. And we take the blog seriously.
Okay, so good. I'm glad to hear.
Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to hear A Student's Guide to the Opera. And we're going to hear some music from Lady Jams. So stay tuned, everyone.
The world is a better place because of Kim Kardashian's empire,
Cheetos,
fleece material,
and Discorder.
It's a local independent music magazine from CITR.
Which means that we can print whatever we heckin' want.
Album and live show reviews, interviews with artists, and sweet illustrations grace our pages.
And even you, listener, can contribute. Just visit CITR.ca/discorder/contribute. You can grab it around town or read it at discorder.ca.
Forever local and forever free.
Save the date for Pivots and Spins, Access Gallery's annual auction fundraiser on November 18th at 7 p.m. Promising to be Access's most exciting auction yet, Pivots and Spins features spectacular work generously donated by over 50 local and international artists, including Eli Bornowski, Daria Ake, Cindy Machizuki, Kathleen Ritter, and Sandra Semchuk. Complete with handcrafted cocktails, organic BC wines from Summerhill Pyramid Winery, Pilsner from Steam Whistle Brewery, works expertly framed by Fine Art Framing, and music organized by CITR 101.9 FM. Check out www.accessauction.tumblr.com for more details about contributing artists, the silent auction, and live auction works.
UBC Theatre and Film presents a world premiere shining with love and possibility. Wives and Daughters by Jacqueline Firkins, based on Elizabeth Gaskell's Victorian serial novel, is a charming romp of love convoluted by hidden desires and expectations.
I like to be liked, but when people carry their affection too far, they become troublesome.
Cynthia's a sweet girl and charming, but she was always in some spot of trouble. She wasn't mischievous exactly, but mischief seemed to follow her.
Join us from November 9th to 25th at the Frederick Wood Theater.
After a certain age, a daughter becomes inconvenient.
So we must stop being inconvenient daughters and become inconvenient wives?
Theaterfilm.ubc.ca.
Hi, my name's Matthew. When I first got back from a military tour in Afghanistan, any time I heard a siren or even a car alarm, I'd lose it completely. I would turn into a wild man, screaming, waving my arms. People would yell at me, "Shut up, you crazy. Get a job, would ya?" Well, I didn't go out and get a job. I got help instead. Now, I'm in a clean and safe apartment. I have friends and helpers who understand me. I landed a decent job. But I gotta admit, I still don't like car alarms or sirens. I used to think mental illness was a death sentence. I got life instead.
This message was produced by Columbian Center Society and Radio Malaspina in British Columbia.
Welcome back to the UBC Happy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam and Coast Salish territory. Up next, we have Arts Update with Amy Sanjo, and she's going to let you know all about the arts offerings on campus in the upcoming week and hear her student's guide to the opera.
Hi there, this is Amy Sanjo here with your weekly arts update. I'll be going over all of the arts events happening on campus this week. So starting off with today, Friday, November 10th, we have our Lace Up for Kids improv show. So you can come and see UBC Improv put on our usual made-up show full of laughs and comedy, but this time it's for a good cause. So proceeds will go to the Rare Disease Foundation and the BCCH Foundation to help raise money for children with rare diseases. Also happening today, Peddling Art Bike Auction is happening. I talked about it last week. I did an interview with two people helping out with it, Sin Williams and Sunny Nestler. So I'll go over it again for those who missed that. It's a silent art auction fundraiser featuring art from over 20 local artists alongside live performances, a plethora of raffle prizes, and a cash bar. So proceeds will go to the BC Libre and Pedals for People programs. So both programs provide bikes, bike accessories, and mechanical assistance to people who cannot afford them, taking donated bikes otherwise destined for the trash and refurbishing them with the help of volunteers. Last thing happening tonight is Si o No. It's a 19-plus pit party by the Latin Dance Club. It's basically a big old Latin dance party at the pit. And if you're a beginner, no worries. They will have a Latin Dance 101 class at the beginning. So come whether you're just trying it for the first time or you're basically a pro. There's also a dress code for this event. Wear green to this event if you're single. Red if you're in a relationship. Yellow if it's complicated, and black if you want to be mysterious. Also, 75% of the profits from this event will go to the Development and Peace Organization. So this whole Friday, any event you go to, it's for a good cause. That's really nice. The Latin Dance Party will be from 9:30 to 2 at the pit, and it's $10 at the door. Definitely hit that up. That sounds like a really, really fun event. This weekend is kind of free of a lot of events, but starting Tuesday, November 14th, CITR is actually having an event, so it's DJ 101.9 Women and LGBTQ2IA Plus Night Drop-In DJ Training. It's a drop-in DJ workshop for cis women, trans women, intersex, two-spirit, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, non-binary, gender fluid, and LGBTQA folks. So if you're under that umbrella in any sort of way, come out to this night. It's led by a special guest host, Regular Fantasy. And this session is going to focus on setting up and working with vinyl turntables and mixers, different ways to have a radio show, and also finding your own DJ style. So if you're at all interested in coming and learning how to DJ or even hosting your own radio show, this is a great, great event for you. And it's free. It's open to all experiences. So if you have absolutely none or you're basically a DJ queen, you can come on into this. And it's from 7 to 9 at the CITR radio station on the bottom floor of the Nest. Also on Tuesday, Blank Vinyl Project is having one of its songwriter sessions. So if you're a beginning songwriter looking to learn the craft, or if you're a very experienced one just looking for some feedback on songs you've already wrote, these sessions will help you improve your songwriting skills with activities like guided writing exercises, prompts to help you continue writing when facing writer's block, and seminars led by experienced musician and songwriters working in the field. So go to the Facebook event to RSVP. That's how you can get into these sessions. There'll be more later on in the year. And this one is from 7 to 9 in the Hatch Art Gallery. Wednesday, November 15th. First thing that's happening that day is Dance Horizons presents D&H and Donuts. Basically, Dance Horizons is going to bring some Krispy Kreme donuts to the Nest. It's $1 per donut and $10 per box from 12 to 3 in the Nest. I will be there. Go support them. Next, Unlimited Dance Club is having a workshop. So it's an advanced hip-hop choreography workshop, and it'll be taught by special guest Maria Villanueva. And she has danced with crews such as Praise Team Showcase, Style and Grace, and 247 Company. So she's a very, very experienced dancer. I think you could learn a lot from her. And if you're into hip-hop, this is going to be a really cool, cool dance class. From 5 to 6:30 in room 2301 of the Nest, and it's $8 for non-Dance Horizon members. Thursday, November 16th, the Film Society and Undergraduate Film Students Association present Wong Kar-wai Night. So you can come to that and check out a screening of the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai's Chungking Express. And there's a post-film discussion from the Undergraduate Film Students Association. So come and see a really, really great movie. And then you can get a discussion afterwards where you can hash out the ideas you had about the film, maybe get different insights from different people. Sounds like an overall really cool night. And it's from 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. at the Nest. It's free if you're a member of the Film Society. If not, you can just buy your membership there. It's only $5. So not too expensive. Pretty, pretty cheap. And also happening this week, I mentioned it last week, but Wives and Daughters is going on at the Frederick Wood Theater. So it's a play adapted by the UBC Theater and Film professor Jacqueline Firkins from the 1860s serial novel by Elizabeth Gaskell, and all about a young woman's life. It's turned upside down when her stepmother and stepsister move in with her, and they like to improve people, but they also come in with a lot of secrets. So this production will showcase our BFA actors and the BFA design and production students. So come to that. It's Wednesday to Saturday, playing until the 25th of November. It's $24.50 for adult tickets, $16.50 for senior tickets, $11.50 for students, and $5 for youth. I will be seeing it next week, so you can come join me. I think it'll be really, really good. I'm really excited to see our talented actors and the designs. I've seen the costumes for it, and it looks amazing. Also, the last two updates, I believe. I told you guys to go and see the UBC Opera's performance of Orfeo and Eurydice. I went and saw it last Saturday, and I just wanted to say it was very, very well done. I was really amazed by the production. I had no idea that we had such talented students here. And it was also my first opera, and I feel like a lot of people out there were kind of like me, where I wanted to see an opera, but I had no idea what to expect, if there was like something special I had to do. So I'm just going to tell you guys about my experience, and maybe it'll give you some insight into what it'll be like. And if you've wanted to go to the opera, maybe this will convince you to actually go and do it. So number one, I wasn't really sure if there was a dress code. Because when I think of the audience of an opera, I immediately think of like ball gowns and people wearing tuxedos, but that was not the case here. So people were in all sorts of different dress. So people were in suit and tie and cocktail dresses, but I saw one guy in Adidas track pants. So you don't really have to dress up really fancy for this. Probably look presentable, but you don't really have anything to fear. If that was what was holding you back, not having a ball gown, don't let it hold you back anymore. So yeah, just come in something nice, but there's no expectation for what you have to wear. Number two, I was kind of worried that I wouldn't understand it. I might be alone on this, but I thought that when people went to the opera, they just understood what the singers were saying, even though it was sung, you know, in opera style and in a different language. But the opera is not just for multilingual intellectual people. They have surtitles over the opera, so whatever the singers are singing, you can see it written above. So it just tells you basically the lines they're singing, and then it takes you about 5 seconds to read that, but it takes them about 30 seconds or more to sing it. So during that time, you get to listen to the opera singers kind of just revel in their technical brilliance. It's absolutely amazing, the singing they do. And you can also watch their emotional performances. I didn't realize how well the acting would be. You think of opera as just someone standing and singing, but they were straight up acting. The lead woman in it was like on the floor, doubled over singing. I don't know how she did that, but it was very, very impressive. Also, the third thing that I was a bit worried about was, what if it's boring? So I kind of thought opera would be boring. Most people do. It's kind of presented as that a lot in different media. I mean, everyone has different tastes, so maybe it'll be boring for you. I hope not. But opera wouldn't really be around that long if it was considered boring to most people. It's always changing, it's always evolving, and it's always like seeking to remain relevant throughout the ages. So whatever show you go to, they'll probably present it maybe in a way that makes sense to modern audiences, and you can always find a universal theme or truth in it. The particular show I went to was based off the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, so it had a timeless quality to it because it was based off Greek mythology. It was something that I knew, and so it was not very intimidating. Others, maybe you need to do a bit more reading before to understand it, but this one was really clear and easy to understand, so don't let that hold you back. The next opera will be sometime in January. I'll be talking about it more when it happens. So I recommend just testing out the waters and going to see it. I mean, it's not that expensive, especially compared to the other opera you could see down in like New York. It's student run and it's really talented, supporting your fellow students. I really recommend it. It's definitely, at least try it once. And I think you guys will be pleasantly surprised at how enjoyable it is. So thank you for listening to my little review or ramble about the opera. And thanks for listening to the Arts Update, and I hope you find something cool to go to this week. Thanks.
So thanks for that, Amy. She did a great job covering the opera. I had no clue really what to do at the opera, so thank you for letting me know. So thank you everyone for listening to UBC Happy Hour. The show airs every Friday from 5 to 6. You can catch all episodes podcasted online at citr.ca. So I'm Alex Lenz. I'm the coordinator for the show, and we were joined today by...
I'm Emma Hicks, the opinion and blog editor at the UBC.
I'm Julia Ferry, and I'm a volunteer.
I'm Sadie Lai, a collective member.
And I'm Lilane. And coming up next is one of UBC's very own all-girl bands called Lady Jams. Lady Jams is a group of ladies from very diverse backgrounds. Their influences range from hip-hop to Bollywood to jazz. Missy D, Fire MC, Sejal Lal, Heavenly Vocals and Violin Shredder, and Roya B, vocalist and beatbox queen, form Lady Jams' unique sound. They make music with meaning in hopes it uplifts and inspires you.
Awesome. So we're going to hear their track Home. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we'll see you guys next week. You'll hear us next week. Yeah. Thanks.
Not true, the words I speak, I close my eyes and pick the pick of what is home to me, a place of L-O-V-E, fun friends that find me like we say it usually, it's where they find my meal, the rupture than Kigali, my mix is with spicy, but thought I was from Trini, African-American, yo, you Jamaican, honey dear, an accent, maybe it's French, but I'm really African, everybody know what color, yeah, my motherland, it's a record, so I blend it, call me Coco, Oreo, curry, soy sauce, I'm a blend of those. No girl, yes, I suppose, cause it's hot with the acquaintances. It's hard to define where my home is. But I'm used to my dad going to bed early. My mom cooking with some maji-maji. My bro playing off that Thierry Henry. Playing with my sisters while I was just three, dog. Ebony, back in the day, the discovery of what a, ha, what is home to me? I said, oh, what is home to me? What I say, what I say? Home is where I belong. Home is where I belong. I call it home. I call it home. Yeah. Yeah. A first song about where I belong. I flew around the world. I transited in the airport. You never heard. Flying over moat, yes, in the future. Home is really easy, see your weather. You fall.